In this sitting position, if this is real Zazen Shikantaza, we can embrace all the suffering of all the sentient beings and absorb and sense their shrieking voices and turn into Dharma sound. This is what I perceived from your talk, Kakuji. Am I right or not enough yet? Not enough. My understanding from your talk last evening. Sorry? Sprout. Excellent. Sorry. I'm too tiny to sprout. But I really wanted to confirm to my understanding through your talk last evening. Oh, am I right or not enough? What I perceived in this sitting position, if this is genuine Kantara, selfless sitting, we can embrace and absorb and sense and all the suffering of all sentient beings in this sitting position and turn into Dharma sound. Yes? And is this what you talked last evening? From your background, of the voice. So is my understanding right? This is for me. Very touching. So now, we already. Let me check. We already gain already this Shikantaza. Gain your talk this. And last evening, Kakuji, you. few talks, Metta Sila, Metta Sila. Genyo talks, Shikantaza, that is Sunyata Samadhi. So we talked this and this Metta Sila, this. And this evening, our subject is truth and body prajna. This, no? This, no? Truth. What is truth? In fact, this was my original subject and the question. Truth. Truth is being pursued and investigated and researched, studied and clarified or embodied and actualized not only by Zen practitioners but also not only by Zen practitioners, not only by Buddhists, not only by religious people, but also by many scientists and philosophers and free thinkers, non-religious people, or after all human beings. We have tried to clarify and embody the truth. But mostly we are conditioned very limited way. Conditioned. For example, science. The way of investigation, it is conditioned. Am I right? Mostly scientists. They start their research or investigation with a sort of hypothesis. Hypothesis. Any problem? Not only scientists. We all have a sort of hypothesis to begin or to start for truth. And I was not satisfied at all in such a way to start with something. Same condition. My original question was, what is the truth? And what should I do now and in my life? This was my original question. Before I met with Zen, when I was secondary school boy, I had this homework, my own homework. And of course I read many books and asked questions. Now what I now feel is Shikantaza. No condition. No condition, I feel. Ah, but even Shikantaka, of course, we have each one of us. Even I sitting for unconditionally, selfless. But we all have habits, habitual characteristics, and karmic nature, karmic distortion. We don't know ourselves. As Genjo told, we are black holes, each one of us. And sitting in the center of the spider's nest. Is this spider's nest or sitting position of the Shikantaka? How can we know? Well, this, when I listened to you talk, this is a huge koan, I felt. We need to confirm this. Which, am I now sitting in the spider's nest? In the center of the spider's nest, or real Shikantaka, sitting position. I got a new koan. Since just 3 days ago, this is my year, and resolved my question. Through my experience, when I visited my master, I asked, what is life? What is the real truth? Suddenly my master grabbed my shoulder and shook me and said, this is it. I couldn't understand, of course, because my question, my state in the being itself was too intellectual to accept his whole body answer. He embodied, he was shown by whole existence. Then I couldn't understand, so he perceived my confusion, and he recommended me and gave me the koan, so I asked my master, if I really concentrate on the whole heart to do this. My original question, homework, what is the truth, what should I do now and in my life? This homework is really get the answer. I asked my master immediately, and he said, yes. If so, I do. So I participated in session, and I began with the moon. This was my really starting point of my Zen practice. My question completely put aside and just with breath. That was very so what did I get? What did I experience through this? Yeah. What I really experienced is infarction. My master servant shook my shoulder. This is it. And then he said, what I experienced? Move universe. This one breath, this one step, this one, that is real embodiment of there is no other. My master's master also replied, one is all is one. And really this is each time I experience the embodiment of all. And my original question, disappeared because of so useless. This is the truth. Truth is always so concrete, embodied. So since then, whatever I need, whatever I need, whatever I look for, everything is my real answer, only answer. Everything becomes answer. Everything I need, whatever I need, that is my answer for my original question. And this is what I... So since then, about 2 or 3 months, sometimes only with my master and myself in Fukokuji. And whatever I look at, everything is wonderful. In the very snowy place then, snow is falling. Oh, wonderful. And I cry. So, I wanted to share this, my experience, what I see. So now, yesterday I mentioned, when I sat in the empty temple, in the mountain empty temple, I went to my bicycle every day to sit. And in the backyard of the temple, when I opened the sliding door, this is backyard soil and sunlight. And ants, insects, sometimes worms. They are traveling, walking. I watched So now I recognize the difference between the observation, for example, scientific observation, science, in science, anyway, very objective observation to inquire or to investigate. But we chant the Heart Sutra. Heart Sutra. Shōken gōon kaifu. In the Heart Sutra, we chant Shōken. Shōken, Thich Nhat Hanh translated this Shōken. The heart in the book of heart, the heart of understanding. He translates shed light on, shed the, to really see by shedding light on, I remember my experience, what I sat in and watching the insects or ants. This is a sort of shōken, shedding light on them. They were not objects. Just when I open empty space for them to, therefore, not I look, they come opposite. Myriad things, we remember Denmata, Dogen, Genjo Fon, simply. Medial things come in. I experience. Aha, experience us. Not I experience, not I like this. No, opposite way. This is shōken. This is a difference between scientific observation or investigation and way of Zen, way of touching shōken. This is very different, I see. This is what I now recognize. Science always has the object there. Therefore, subject, suddenly subject is here. So, separation. And this, in this matter, for the past probably 10 years, I learned from you, Genjo, very much also. So now I would like to ask you to even talk in the subject of truth and body prajna. What's true? What's truth? What's concrete? What's genuine? What's life? What's the universe? They become for me the same question. Seems strange, but my ongoing investigations about this this topic. Can you hear me, by the way? What is truth? What is concrete? What is genuine? What is the universe? What is life?
At this point, I don't see any distinction between these questions, whereas I used to think they were very different. But recently, I was very lucky. In relation to this question about what is prajna and its relation to truth, I was very lucky that I came across some words of Zen master Basui. So for me, he's a very special master. I've only seen a few fragments of Zen master Basui. But on the internet, I found. And then it said just right before he died, he said, don't be misled. Look directly what is this. So I was shocked. So really, I felt shocked. So immediately, it became a question for me. So how are we being misled? And so how do we look directly? And of course, what is this? So over the years with Haugenson, he's often mentioned this. And for me, it became a very special koan. So does everyone know what a koan is? Does everyone? Okay, so in Zen they have, in the Rinzai school, typically they have a library of these koans or cases, which are dialogues or interactions with ancient masters. But that's not the point. The point of the koan often has two aspects, like a contradiction. So in my case, I'll share with you with this koan this. The two aspects were, on the one hand, this is obvious, isn't it? We all know this is obvious. We all know intuitively this is very, very obvious, isn't it? But yet, somehow I had a feeling that I was missing something. It was very elusive. Do you share such a they're the two aspects. One is obvious, and the other is, I feel I missed. So these were for me the two aspects of this koan. And this koan is a very good koan because it's like two jaws of a mouth. There's not much room between them. So if you genuinely subject yourself to this koan, there's not much room to hide. So for me, it's been a very, very useful koan. So in terms of Busui's words, don't be misled. Okay. Look directly. What is this? Okay. So I started to ask myself, why are we misled? So what is misleading us? And then immediately I thought, very, very quickly I thought of, there was a philosopher, Alfred North Whitehead. He was writing philosophy in the 1920s when quantum theory was being developed. So I don't know whether he knew about it. But his philosophy is very, very radical. And I'm not going tonight to try and explain philosophy, but there's one aspect I think that's related to this Basui's remark, don't be misled. He talked about the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. So that's philosophy speak. But what he's saying is that we objectify our world, our universe, and we think that these objects are concrete. Okay, so for example, I can say this is a bell. Okay, is that a concrete fact? Okay, is it a concrete fact? Well, no. So even though this looks substantial, this looks very, very concrete, this is a bell, I could have, while you were doing yoga, take this real bell away and set up a very clever computer imaging to produce the hologram. Okay. So that's an example, but really when we say this is a bell, this is an assumption. Okay. So in order to delve more deeply into this, we need to understand better what an object is. And Haldensheim already mentioned in scientific thought about what objects are. And I remember when I first started chemistry at high school, the first thing we did in chemistry class was we got a flame. We got a candle, and then our task was to look at the flame, so to describe it scientifically. And so what we did, so for example, we measure, get the temperature, we measure its temperature, we write down its colour, we look at its form, different colours, blue, orange, etc. So, but what you notice there is that we're like a detached observer, isn't it? So we are these detached observers, and then we are sort of treating this flame, this candle, as an object. And in science, how we know object is like we establish its properties. Okay, so that's a few nights ago I mentioned a wonderful essay by Erwin Schrödinger. He talked about this, the principle of objectivation. He wrote this essay in the 1950s. And he said in this process, as I just described, we take a step back and we become an onlooker. There's some separation, and by that very step back, we create an objectified universe. We create the object. So he wrote that essay he called it the principle of objectivation, because he was saying this is one of the fundamental principles of science. Okay. But isn't it true? Isn't it true that we in our everyday life do the same thing? So isn't it often that when you look at something, for example, the bell, that you feel that I'm here and the bell is out there, is an object? A common mode of existence, isn't it? And so Schrödinger he didn't mean to criticize the principle of objectivation, because in science it seemed useful. But what he was pointing out is, one thing I remember very clearly, he said that when we do that, we get a very lifeless universe. So cold, mute, coldless. Because we've been taken out as an onlooker, and then we just create these objects. And he gave an example, I remember, where he said he was addressing the lady readers, and he said, imagine if your child has come to you with a new toy and it's got wonderful sparkling eyes, that he wrote. And so you, as a mother, you would have such a wonderful happiness, awareness of happiness. And the principle of objectivation says, oh no, those sparkling eyes in the child, they're just photons. They're just photons glancing off the eye of your child, reflecting and hitting your retina. Isn't that such a very cold universe? But this is not only true for science. Don't you feel in our everyday experience that there is this indirectness? Okay, so we're dealing with these objects, and it seems also very, very indirect. It doesn't seem very, very alive. I've experienced that many times. And I've been wondering what's causing this. So far we've said that this object is essentially based on an assumption. But there's also the second aspect, is this onlooker, this observer, this subject that is also created as a part of that process. So it's like an imaginary observer. That's how we go through. Imaginary observer, we move through life, and through this imaginary observer, we observe and this world of objects. So we've got this separation. But you can ask yourself, like, if I think that separation in my experience is very, very clear. Other people feel that also. So I feel I'm here, and the world's out there. Do you all feel that? So I remember Yasutani Roshi, which is the Dharma brother of Hogenstein's master. He said once, our biggest problem is that thinking that I'm here and the world is out there. He's very, very clear about that. So far, we've established that when we're dealing with objects, through our daily mode of experience, it's a very, very indirect sort of experience of life. Also, it's fundamentally based on assumption. The assumption is that that object is concrete, and also there is this assumption that there is an imaginary observer that's taking in all those, this world of objects out there. Okay, so I think this is, I think, the basis in my investigation so far, why we are being misled. Okay. So if we want to know truth, if we want to know what is genuine, as Hogenstein, we shouldn't be based on an assumption, should it? We want an assumptionless truth, isn't it? The genuine truth doesn't have any assumptions. This one with objects, as I've tried to clarify, is already based on at least two assumptions. And you can check. You can check whether you hold this objectified view of the world. So you can ask yourself the question. So if you get up and you walk outside, okay, and you come back, do you believe that that is the same bell? Okay. Of course, we know in physics that the atoms have changed, but in terms of everyday practical, in terms of the everyday mode of experience, do you believe that that is the same bell? And a more dramatic form of this question is, when you die, do you believe that the universe will continue to exist? But isn't it that when you look up at the sky at night, you look up, you're this onlooker and you see these galaxies and planets and the moon. Aren't they just like objects, like the Newtonian view of the world, that there are these objects out there, some of them so, so far away. So don't we think that we're just independent of them, so when we die, that they'll continue to exist? So that's by those two questions, I'm trying to demonstrate that with our objects, we have this habit, this really deep habit, that they persist, that these persist independently of us. Okay, and of course, this is a very, very practical. But to go away out of the room and then and to come back and have the belief that the bell is still here is very, very practical. But I'm not talking about practicalities here. We're talking about the truth, what's genuine. Okay. So we've got. So already we see the objectified universe is already full of assumption, and that's why Whitehead he said we've got this fallacy of misplaced confidence. We say these objects are concrete. So that's the first part. This is, I think, so far my investigations of how we're being misled. Second is, okay, look directly, he said, look directly. Okay, so once again we'll go back to the flame. Okay, so instead of now, you're the scientist or you're looking at and you're trying to establish its properties. So now you put your finger in the flame. Okay, so where's the object now? So isn't that experience? Very, very quick, very, very experienced. Hot! You put your finger in the flame. So is there any object there? If you put your finger in the flame, can you find an object there? No, that's an experience. So Whitehead said that is a throb of experience. And his philosophy is very, very radical because most philosophies are based on objects. And Whitehead said the basic elements of reality aren't objects, they are throbs of experience. Or Hogenstein would say encounter. So this is very, very radical. So when you put your finger in the first experience, there's no object. Objects and experience are totally different, aren't they? So by putting your finger, you can already, there is no assumption of an object left. Just through that experience, the assumption of the object has dropped off. Now we ask yourself, is the onlooker there? Is this imaginary observer? When you put your finger in the flame, is the imaginary observer there also? Is it? Some years ago at the Sangsuriya, so she and I had a clear experience of this. When during yoga, I did a handstand, and I pulled suddenly I felt in my neck, I felt a muscle go. And so at that time I thought it was all right, and then I went to bed. In the middle of the night, I had to go to the toilet. And it was excruciating. I couldn't move my head. So I didn't realize how many muscles we need to keep our head up. But certainly this one was excruciating. So I'm dying to go to the toilet, and every time I move my head, pain. So finally I said, okay, I really need to go to the toilet. So I got up, and I walked to the toilet. While I was in the toilet, I was standing over there. And then I was in so much pain, I couldn't go to the toilet, even though I wanted to. And then my whole awareness was just this pain. That's all there was, the experience of pain. There was the pain was so intense, I couldn't objectify it. Normally, when the pain is a little bit less intense, we feel, we have the experience of pain, and then suddenly we objectify it, and then this observer, this imaginary observer appears, or the subject, says, I don't like that, I want to do something about that. So we get that duality. But in this case, this experience was so intense, there was no room for that. So I confirmed absolutely that there, in such an experience, there's no object, and there's no onlooker either. Huge pain. In some ways, it was liberating to be like that. So when we move from the world of objects to experience, already we see that the two assumptions have dropped off, isn't it? But there's the other assumption about the same. So with objects, we very, very easily say, this is the same object. So we go out of the room, we come back, we see this is the same bell. Okay? Even in Zazen, so when you start Zazen, sometimes what you can do, isn't it, we want to observe our breath. We want to be aware of our breath. Isn't it very easy to create breath as an object? So we create this observer that's observing this breath as an object. Maybe you've experienced this. And also we judge, we got this observer is judging, and it's not quite right. So I guess I've experienced this many times in Zazen, such a imaginary observer objectifying my breath. But then I sometimes wondered why we get bored in Zazen. I feel the reason could be is because objects, we think we know them, because we've established the properties. Okay, this is a bell, I know its shape. It's like we put it in a little box. Yeah, I know what this is about, and then I don't need to worry about it anymore. We can't discover the bell anymore because we know its properties. So in Zazen, when we objectify our breath, objectify the breath, this breath is the same as the last one, and it'll be the same as the next one. So I think this is maybe one of the reasons we can become easily bored when we objectify the breath. I think boredom creeps in very easily. That's perhaps a sign that you're objectifying your breath if you're bored. Because like Schrödinger said, the objectified universe is lifeless. It's mute, cold, and boring. And also in our everyday relationships, when I think sometimes, like of our partner, sometimes I feel that I objectify my partner. Because in certain situations, I feel that I know how she'll react. Okay? So I've seen this before. So it's like I'm treating her like an object. Oh yes, you can objectify yourself. You can objectify yourself. So with these objects, we easily say it's the same, but with experience, it's different, isn't it? So when you put your finger in the flame, when you do it again, you don't say it's the same experience. It's a new one, isn't it? So even in everyday language, this is clear. So we say this is the same object very, very easily. But in everyday language, it reflects our intuition that experience is new and unique. We say, I had the same sort of experience. We don't easily say, I had the same experience. Okay. So that this is very, very, I think, very illuminating about to change. I think deep down we have, like Schrodinger talked about the principle of objectivation. I think we humans have the habit of objectivation. And this has become very, very deep-seated. And we have all these assumptions associated that I've been talking about. We don't question them anymore. So I found in my investigations about body, we really need to dig these assumptions out. Okay, put them to light, and then see them, and do they hold up? Are they real? Okay, so what is real? So look directly. So we've seen that each experience is new, isn't it? So when you put your finger, so let's look at the bell. So how do we look directly at the bell? And so I'm talking about experience. Experience is very hard to convey in words. So before I said this is a bell, okay? That involves an object, okay? Now I change. I say I see the bell. Okay, that's already starting to change because that's the experience of seeing, isn't it? Seeing the bell. But we already said the eye is an assumption, so we don't need the eye. So seeing the bell. But then I feel the bell is still an object, so what it is, if you characterize it in words, is bell seeing. That's the experience. Not I see the bell, where I is the subject, bell is the object. Bell seeing, that reflects, characterizes the experience. Actually, I learned this from my son, David, when he was very young. And we were walking down the steps together, and he was just learning to walk, and I was holding his hand. And then suddenly he lost his balance. And I was holding his hand, so he didn't fall down. But then he could only use the foot, and then he said, falling. That was the only thing he said. He said, I'm not, he hasn't got this imaginary observer yet. He didn't say, I'm falling. He just described the experience, falling. So I looked at bell seeing. That's the in words, the experience. So, but this is last. This is the last is, what is this? Okay, so as I said, in experience, it's very, very hard. You can't convey experience in words. So I'm trying to characterize this difference between, this very, very crucial difference between objects and experience. So when you get to what is this, okay, and I'm grateful for Kakaji who talked yesterday about his experience with the bell. So I had a couple of years ago with this very, I shouldn't say the same bell. I had a similar, very meaningful experience. So this time Kakaji was in the afternoon, for me it was in the morning. So during Sesshin, one thing is that you're in everyday life outside, we are very typically very, very fragmented, and our awareness is not so clear. But during Sesshin, what can happen is that your awareness can become very, very sensitive. So I was sitting in Zazen, and then someone hit the bell. And it's like Kakuji said that so it was the bell experience. So the whole background awareness was actualizing as the sound of this bell. Very similar to that experience with the pain. So no, there was no object, no onlooker. Just the sound of this bell. Very, very live. Very, very vivid. No, there were no boundaries to this experience at all. Very, very live. Very, very vivid. Very, very direct. Very, very concrete. Very, very genuine. Such an experience I had. And then, so you can say, so in words, if I have to use words, that is a new, use Whitehead, that's a throb of experience. Okay? Or a new bell hearing experience. So at that point, you're looking directly. This is what I feel Gosui Roshi is saying. We look directly. There's no intermediate assumptions. Just a very, very direct experience. So a new bell hearing experience. Whitehead, Basui Roshi said, look directly. We don't. That doesn't necessarily mean we look with our eyes. We can look with our ears also. So there's a new bell hearing experience. A new bell. A new bell life. You could say, new bell life, new bell universe. So at that point, it's your whole universe is just the sound of this bell. And at the same time, that's you. Isn't it incredible? Isn't it incredible? So that's looking directly. And at the same time, as I said a few nights ago, when I described body, I said, for me the most precise description that comes out of such an experience is you are awake as this. So at that point, awake fully is the sound of the bell. Such a clear throb encounter. But it's not an encounter of life, I think. To talk about the prajna, before such an experience, you know, I read Dogen's words. He said, if you try to experience the dharmas, that's delusion. But if the dharmas experience you, that is realization. Dogen has very strange, isn't it a very strange thing to say? It's quite unusual. But after such an experience, it's absolutely clear what Dogen mean. After that, absolutely clear. So this is with such an experience. Also comes understanding. But in this diagram, the you see the body, sunyata metta, points. Okay, so. To me, like such a bell hearing, that's like a point experience. So it's timeless. You can say it's timeless, but I don't mean that clock has stood still. So I think I'm not talking about clock time. I think it's timeless in the sense, in my understanding, that psychological time is no longer present. So normally when we have, I spoke about the self. When we have this imaginary observer in the self, we have these intentions, we have these objectives, and we line them up. I need to do this, I need to do this. Out of that, that's how we create psychological time. But in the future, I need to achieve this, I need to get this. So that's how we get this continuum in the future. But also in the past, maybe there are some special, precious experiences or sufferings we had. We also hold on to them. We have the continuum in the past. So when in the objective world, just like Newton said, it's like this mechanical universe. It's full of continuums. We've got this continuum of time. But I hope it's clear when we talk about the universe of experience, it's discontinuous. that's why Whitehead said it's a throb of experience. So this is a new bell seeing. This is a new bell hearing, a unique one. So the next one is not real next, but it's unique. So that's why these point experiences, they're timeless. To my feeling is that there is no subject, there's no imaginary observer, we don't have this, and consequently we don't have this continual time. It's timeless. There's no psychological time. But here we see Prajna as a line, and that suggests like a quantity. So a point, mathematically, it doesn't have any dimension. So this very suggestive, such an experience, it's a dimensionless experience. But out of that can grow Prajna, for example, in quantity. And then here we're talking about time. Yeah. Time, this can be a process. Okay. So for me, it's been crucial in terms of investigating this issue of body, prajna, what is truth, what is genuine, what is concrete, what is the universe, what is life. Life is very clear. Very, very clear, and that at the same time you realize that's the universe, which is also you. So that's why this talk, really, I've only been talking in a sense. Sunyata, this means no self, also body, awake as this. So in my talk I've been stressing this, but Hogan-san said, and this is true, this is a trinity, so I'd like to say a few words about how metta is involved. Okay, so far sunyata, there's no imaginary observer in such an experience and body awake as this. So metta, this is something, Douglas Harding is a sort of unofficial Zen master. It's also like the Shui Roshi, a very, very special teacher for me. And for Douglas Harding, he taught me this. When we are very empty and the bell is experiencing us, so what is happening is that this self, this black hole, this imaginary observer, we hold on to it. Don't we hold on to it dearly? We try to keep it. This is fundamentally why we feel I'm here and the world is out there. We hold on to it dearly, but in such an experience, we surrender that. It's gone. And because we surrender that, life, genuine life can arise. Isn't this compassion? When Douglas Harding told me that, so we move out of the way, the small self moves out of the way, life can arise majestically. This is very real, very genuine, very concrete. And so I've been talking many words and philosophies and objects, but the genuine teacher is now going to arise. So if you close your eyes, please, for just a few seconds.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So, some years ago at Seshin, during the time after the washing, as we do here, you wash your plate on your own. And I was washing the plate. And once again, normally when we wash the plate, so I'm here and the plate is out there. So there's this imaginary observer and then we're washing this object out there. Suddenly I felt, I'm washing my own face. I felt very, very much, very strange. I was washing my own face. And then I realized that also that this object-object separation is really, it's not real. Watching this thing is very real. That was the first time with the plate, and so you have. It's very strange because normally we're in this observer object mode. This is the norm, and then when that happens, it's a shock. And then your intellect creeps. What's happening? So then you create another imaginary to try to analyze the experience, and then it's gone. And then it's easily to get, not scared, but you can get easily attached. See what happened, and then I wanted to recreate that experience again. So I tried with Sazen, I tried to recreate. I didn't listen. I thought, each experience is new. I tried to create the same one. So very easily such an experience can be trapped by the shadow. So in a sense, you have to be very wary of your shadow after such an experience. So very easily, in my case, very easily it creeped in and analyzed it and then did all sorts of things, built lots of things, tried to recreate, it becomes a goal, objective. So the actual meaning of the experience is lost if you try to do that, the opposite. Yes, exactly. No, you're right. No. Yes, that's right. It was a very strange, that first time, very strange. I wasn't afraid. So I think everyone's perhaps different. Because we hold on to this it's like a black hole. But I think the analogy with a black hole is very good. It's very, very dense. It's very, very hard to establish what it is because, as I said, itself, when it is very active, that are the points when we have little or no awareness. So just like in physics, they try to analyze a black hole, even by shining light in there, it doesn't escape. So it's very, very hard to analyze black holes because you can't see them, there's nothing, you can't measure them in any sort of way. So self is similar, we need the light of awareness to be shined on. But when the self's active, it's very, and we know, when our ego self is active, how aware are you? No, we're very habitual. But still, background awareness is even in those situations, is possible. Maybe you can, in a sense, be aware of what's going on. Uh-huh. Yes. As you said, the question came, who is feeling the pain? Who is being afraid? Could be. But also I feel that I think there's one misunderstanding. I don't want to leave that in any way such experiences are remote. Like when we're talking about body, okay, when I first started Zen, I really wanted to become enlightened. I thought this is the goal of enlightenment. To be Zen is to become enlightened. So I really chased enlightenment. I thought I was like a caterpillar sitting on my cushion, and then suddenly some transformation, and then I would be a beautiful butterfly. Such a idea I had about what body is, what enlightenment is. But and that story about the Buddha, how he went through all many challenges, and then he was sitting under a tree, and suddenly something happened. A whole religion was built up around it. In some ways, the danger can be that it's remote. So it's almost impossible. I think this is a belief that very easily can creep in, and when it goes deep, it becomes a big obstacle. When I first started practicing Zen, there was a senior student of Genpo Roshi. I remember one of the first times he gave a talk, he said it's only a hair's breadth away. And I didn't understand but that such an experience is only a hair's breadth away. So I didn't understand at the time, but it's not remote. Don't think that. There's nothing special about me. Nothing special about me.
For Dharma. One thing, just one thing, because now it is dinner time. No? We chant Metta Sutta every day in this meeting. How many times do we need to chant to become compassionate? One chant. Oh, one chant, no? We really want to get this, or to get this, or to get this, to be compassionate, to become a compassionate being, or to get enlightenment, or to be free from all our delusional association, mental association. We all have such a... but can we? We have such an intention to get, for example, this, or to be compassionate. So opposite direction, Our intention always like this. Very paradoxical. But in order to, if you really want to be or to become compassionate being, you need this understanding. Look at this line. This line. If you really understand life, understanding inevitably take you, guide you to this metta being, compassionate. So this diagram is wonderful, very, very. This one, in order to get this, you need this. In order to get this enlightenment, you need this. Samadhi. Samadhi. Right. In order to get your selflessness, your daily precepts is necessary. If you break precepts daily, you cannot get this. So when they, if you want this, you need to practice this also. If you want this, we need to practice this. Like this. So, Kai, Jo, this, three learnings, we call it three learnings. In Japanese, san, gaku. San means three. Gaku means learning. And this is very essential, not only for Buddhism, but the Christianity or any, even Muslims. This is essential. This is the essence of any religion or even philosophy. You need. This is the essence of all essences of life. And then the embodiment, the real embodiment of all of this is this. This is the embodiment. Therefore, I put this. This is the embodiment, this encounter, is the embodiment of all of this. And vice versa. This embodiment of this. So understanding give you, and your real understanding gives you the compassionate yourself. It all depends on ourselves, whether we are black hole in the spider's nest, or just selfless being, compassionate being in this sitting position. Well, either possible, depends on our this awareness. Depends on this awareness. This. You can make this even spider's nest, this. Depends on this, this awareness. Yeah. One more. Yeah. Sorry. To learn sutra is helpful for that.
But also one to avoid
depends on the way or your way of learning sutra. You can learn really with this. But also we can learn with our intellectual level. That is not so helpful. Depends on our way of learning. Even metta sutta. If we really intellectual. Please try not to make hard sutra so intellectual. That is your side, your fault. Hard sutra is hard sutra. It is truth. Describe the truth. But hard sutra itself intellectual or no. We can make any sutra, anything in yes, but but whatever paradox we have, full of paradox, but depends on ourselves, depends on our But in fact, like this, if you want to get this, you need this, like this. If you want this, all connected. We can't separate, Okay, thank you.